Welcome, and thank you all for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. At that time, you can press star one to ask a question. I would also like to inform all parties that this call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's call over to Ms. Gabriela Bassat. Thank you. Please begin.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for being here today. We're running through some technical issues, so if you can bear with us for 30 more seconds, we hope we'll figure it out in very soon. So. Okay, so while my colleagues here are working through the technical issues, I'm just going to welcome you to our second quarterly VFA provider webinar. My name is Gabriela Passat, and I'm an adult immunization program specialist with the immunization branch of the California Department of Public Health. The topic of our webinar today, based on the results of the poll you answered during our first webinar back in June, is the adult immunization schedule, and we are very excited to have Dr. Eileen Yamada present on this. It is a very big topic to cover, so I'm just going to quickly mention some very brief housekeeping things that we have to keep in mind. So first, you're going to be muted throughout the duration of the presentation. You're going to be able to ask questions at the very end of the presentation, but please feel free to type in questions in the chat box throughout the presentation. We are recording this. We will be recording, and we're going to be sharing the recording and the slides with you following the webinar today. And you're going to be getting an email from us as soon as those are available. We have two polling questions, and please answer those questions. They're going to be inserted in the presentation, and we really appreciate if you can answer those questions. Your feedback is going to be very helpful for us so we can figure out how we can best support you. And so now I'm going to introduce our presenter today, Dr. Eileen Yamada. She is a public health medical officer in the Clinical and Policy Support Section of the Immunization Branch of the California Department of Public Health. She currently provides technical assistance for local health departments, healthcare providers, and other programs on clinical immunization questions and other current immunization issues. Dr. Yamada is a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics and a member of the American College of Preventive Medicine. She received her MD at UC San Francisco and her Master's of Public Health at UC Berkeley. She completed her residencies in both pediatrics and preventive medicine. So here she is. She will be talking to you about the recommended adult immunization schedule.
Thank you so much, Gabriela. And so what I'll be doing today, I was asked to do this, and this is a pretty big topic, so what I decided to do was concentrate on a few of the key recommendations for adults, and I'm going to end with some potential strategies for your clinic to consider to help improve your adult immunization rates. And throughout this presentation at the end, I also have a number of resources that you can look at after the webinar and use as resources as you move forward with your adult immunization efforts. So this is just my disclosure side. I have no financial conflict of interest with any of the vaccine products I'll be discussing today, and any discussion of off-label uses will be for educational purposes only. So these are my objectives. These are what I'll be covering today. I wanted to describe which patients need the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, 13-valent PCV13, and the polysaccharide vaccine, PPSV23, and explain how to give them in sequence and the appropriate intervals. This is fairly confusing, so I did want to spend some time on that. I also want to describe the recommendation for zoster vaccine for older adults. Then I wanted to talk about explaining why the focus on preventing pertussis really has shifted now to giving Tdap for pregnant women, and also describe the recommendation for influenza vaccine in adults, including pregnant women. And just go make sure you understand that certain vaccines may be indicated based on patient risks, either their medical condition and occupation or other exposures. I do have some slides at the end. I don't know if I have time to cover them, but I have them there for your reference as well. And I will end also in describing potential approaches to improve rates within your clinic. So this slide here is just the recommended schedule. It was published in February of this year in the MMWR, and this particular photo looks at the recommended vaccines on the left and the various age groups in the in columns. Yellow bars indicate when a vaccine is recommended for that age group if they haven't yet received it, and the purple bars indicate when it would be recommended if they had a certain risk indication or medical condition or exposure. This is another page of the recommended schedule, and this slide looks at basically risk indications and for the various vaccines. And as, again, you have the recommended vaccines in yellow and for other risk indications in purple. You'll also see another set of red bars, and that's basically when certain vaccines may be contraindicated in certain populations. And really what we see here is for those live virus vaccines, they're contraindicated for persons who are pregnant and also those who are considered immunocompromised. I first wanted to talk about pneumococcal vaccines, and you're probably aware of pneumococcal disease, which causes hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations a year. A lot of what we see is in adults is pneumonia. We see bacteremia or blood infections or meningitis, and this is a big cause of morbidity and mortality, particularly in our oldest adults. So there are two pneumococcal vaccines. One is Pneumovax, or the 23-valent polysaccharide pneumococcal vaccine. That's been available for a long, long time and has historically always been recommended for older adults and high-risk populations. We know this vaccine, the immunity wanes, so certain folks, immunocompromised, those with A20 are recommended to get a repeat dose five years after their first dose for those 19 through 64 years of age. And what we know about the polysaccharide vaccines, we really only get very limited benefit from repeated doses, unlike some of our other vaccines where you can see a good boost with a booster dose. When you're looking at the two vaccines, if they're both indicated, the polysaccharide vaccine does work best if it's given second after the conjugate vaccine. So again, the other vaccine that I'll be talking about is Prevnar 13 or the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. The 13-valent version became available in 2010, and it replaced the 7-valent version, which had always been historically given to young children. And we know that over time, giving the vaccine, the conjugate vaccine to younger children also provided some protection as we saw less disease in older adults. So we saw good herd immunity from using this vaccine in our young children. The 13-valent vaccine, Prevnar 13, is routinely recommended for all children less than 5 and persons with certain high-risk conditions, and more recently, since 2014, for all adults 65 years of age and older if they hadn't yet received it. It does induce a better immune response, especially with repeated doses, and again, it's led to reduced disease even in unimmunized populations. It tends to work best if you give it before the conjugate vaccine. You get the best immune response giving the conjugate first and then later the polysaccharide. So who needs which vaccines? We know that persons 5 years or older, the younger folks, if they're healthy, they may only get the conjugate vaccine. But for persons 5 years or older, they'll need either both the conjugate and the polysaccharide, or some would just need the polysaccharide vaccines. The age-based recommendations are that all adults 65 years and older should get both of the vaccines. PCV13, if they got it in the past, they wouldn't need it again. But the polysaccharide vaccine, even if they got it before age 65, they would need an additional dose at age 65 or older. There are also risk-based indications for certain high-risk groups. Some may only need the polysaccharide vaccines. And other high-risk groups may need both vaccines. Again, the highest risk and the immunocompromised and those with A20 are going to need that extra booster dose as well before the age of 65 years, and that'll be 5 years after the first one. What we know about PCV13 is that when they looked at the immune responses, you got as good an immune response or better than you saw from the polysaccharide vaccine, and the immune response seemed to be better when the conjugate vaccine was given first versus the polysaccharide vaccine being given first and then the conjugate vaccine. So if somebody hasn't had any pneumococcal vaccines at all, then we always recommend the conjugate first, prior to the polysaccharide to get that good immune response. So now I'll move into the recommendation for adults 65 years of age and older for both vaccines. I wanted to start with this, although I don't know all the Medicare regulations. I remember when this was being negotiated, Medicare had always covered the polysaccharide vaccine, but it was actually one dose of pneumococcal vaccine. So in 2015, and it became effective really right after this vote recommending two different pneumococcal vaccines for older adults, is that they now cover two different pneumococcal vaccines for those 65 years in age and older. But for the regulations in terms of Medicare coverage, those two different vaccines, pneumococcal vaccines, need to be given at least 1 year apart in order to be paid, and that's per the Medicare regulations. So basically, what are the recommendations? Basically, that both PCV13 and PPSV23 should be administered routinely in series to all adults 65 years of age and older. Unlike some vaccines, inactivated vaccines, you don't want to give these at the same visit. If they got PCV13 in the past, they would not need it again after age 65, though. And then looking at those who hadn't had the doses, again, you would want to give the PCV13 first, followed by a dose of the polysaccharide vaccine. And the interval would be, for most adults, it would be at least 1 year after the dose of the conjugate vaccine. However, for those at highest risk, because ACIP was worried about these folks being vulnerable to some of the other serotypes that aren't in the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, they recommend those highest risk, with immunocompromising conditions, functional or anatomic asplenia, CSF leaks, or cochlear implants, that it can be given at least 8 weeks after the conjugate vaccine. But I know that it sort of is in contrast to the regulations, so I don't know what would happen with that, but so these are the ACIP recommendations. You do have to keep at least that 8-week interval, though. But as you know, since the polysaccharide vaccine has been around for quite a long time, a number of folks probably have already received the polysaccharide vaccine, either because they had a high-risk condition before the age of 65 or just because they're now 80 and they received that polysaccharide vaccine in their late 60s. So what do you do with those folks? What they do recommend, if they haven't gotten a dose of the conjugate vaccine, you need to give that, again, at the same interval, at least a year after the most recent polysaccharide dose. If they got the polysaccharide vaccine prior to age 65, again, they're recommended to get another dose of that polysaccharide vaccine. And the interval there would be 5 years between the two different polysaccharide vaccines. And if they got a dose of the polysaccharide vaccine after age 65 already, they would just need that dose of the conjugate vaccine 1 year later. So I just wanted to go through this really briefly. There are certain risk-based pneumococcal vaccine recommendations, and they differ based on the condition. I did want to show this because it gives you a sense of some of the risks for some of the higher risk populations. As you can see, healthy folks are on the left. That shows an incidence of 8 cases per 100,000 persons in adults 18 through 64 years of age in the U.S. This is data from 2009. And then you looked at various risk factors like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, pulmonary disease, kidney disease, liver disease, alcoholism. All those conditions have higher risks than for those who are healthy in that age group, and it's about a 3- to 7-fold increased risk. But then when you look at those persons who are HIV infected or who have hematological cancers, those folks have even higher risk, and that's a 20-fold risk. So that'll help give you a reason why some of the recommendations are the way they are, because I find actually the pneumococcal recommendations very, very difficult. That's why we put together a little guide, IAC has a helpful guide. You can look at the ACIP recommendations, but I urge you to really look at all of these very closely because it is rather confusing, and I probably can't go in total depth into it today, but I will point you to some references. So for those who are indicated for both PCV13 and PPSV23, that includes, again, the age-based recommendations for all adults 65 years and older. Again, if they got PCV13 in the past, they won't need it again, however. And then risk-based recommendations. Those are for the high risk, those who are immunocompromised, and other risk groups that are at high risk, such as those with CSF leaks or cochlear implants. Some groups are indicated for only the polysaccharide vaccine, and for those 19 years and older, that includes those with chronic cardiovascular disease. That does not include solely essential hypertension, however, chronic pulmonary disease, and for adults, that includes having asthma, those with diabetes, those with alcoholism because of the liver disease associated. Cigarette smokers are also indicated for the polysaccharide vaccine, 19 years and older, and those with chronic liver disease or cirrhosis. Again, certain populations will need two doses of the polysaccharide vaccine, and again, those are those who are immunocompromised in some way, and that includes folks who have asplenia, including those with sickle cell disease who have a functional asplenia. Again, immunocompromising conditions, including HIV infection, those with chronic liver disease or nephrotic syndrome. And again, the intervals between the doses there, again, for these folks, if they haven't gotten the conjugate vaccine or the polysaccharide vaccine yet, they should get the conjugate vaccine first and then get the second dose of the polysaccharide vaccine at least 8 weeks. It should be after the PCV13 dose. And if they're indicated for two doses, make sure to give those polysaccharide vaccines at least 5 years apart. I wanted to go through some resources because I really urge you to take a look at these, see which one works best for you. Some you may want to have as a reference because it's more detailed. Others you may want to post up there just as a quick reminder for you. This slide here shows part of a resource from the Immunization Action Coalition for pneumococcal vaccines for high-risk persons. It shows who should get PCV13, who should be getting PSV23, and which of those need that second dose. It's very detailed. This is actually cut and pasted. This is the top of that reference. It's the same reference. Again, looking at those with other high-risk conditions but would not be indicated for that second dose of PPSV23, and only the CSF, those with CSF leaks or cochlear implants need PCV13. But it's a good comprehensive resource, and it's good to have as a reference. I put this up. This is from the CDC's MMWR, I believe was published in 2015 because the intervals were updated at that point. This is a little nice reference to take a look at those intervals. They also have something more detailed looking at all the various age groups because it is rather confusing because the pediatric ones may be different than adults and older adults may be different as well. So this is a summary of all the intervals between the various doses depending on the order you would give it in. We tried to put something together that was simple that maybe you could post up on your in your clinic. It's very colorful. Our INE group did a great job in making this as simple as possible for a very confusing recommendation. This is our pneumococcal vaccine timing for adults, and we also have one for children if you also care for the pediatric population as well, and that's on easyiz.org. So I'll move on now to zoster vaccine. Just a really quick update. As you know, shingles is a reactivation of varicella zoster virus. It's a localized reaction in a dermatome. It's generally very painful, and occurs at increased frequency as you get older, and in those with immunocompromising conditions. The complications also increase with age, and most notably, people who have post-herpetic neuralgia pain, it can persist even a year or longer after the lesions have resolved. And it can interfere with activities of daily living, and complications can also cause hospitalization. And I've talked to people with post-herpetic neuralgia, and it's not something to take lightly. It's very debilitating for those who have severe post-herpetic neuralgia. What we know about the current zoster vaccine, which is a live attenuated vaccine, the protection offered from the vaccine does wane within the first 5 years after vaccination. And we don't really know the duration of protection beyond 5 years. And they're continuing to follow in terms of studies what we think the duration of protection is. But that's kind of an important backdrop to understand why ACIP kept that recommendation for 60 years and above. Just as a aside, I just wanted to mention there is another vaccine, zoster vaccine, going through clinical trials, and so far it looks pretty promising, but I'm just going to say that right now because we don't have any licensure or recommendations yet for that vaccine, but we're looking at it really closely because it may be a promising future. So the recommendation that ACIP put forth for the zoster vaccine is that a single dose of zoster vaccine is recommended for adults 60 years and older. And that's a recommendation from ACIP. When you look at our zoster immunization rates for persons 60 years and older in California, our rate was 33.2% in 2014. It's likely a little higher now, but it's probably not nearly the majority of the population. So we do have a long way to go in immunizing our adult population against zoster. We're hoping that we can partner with you to help improve rates. Oh, so we're at the point for a TDAP poll question, so I'm going to turn this on over to Gabriela Passat to go through the poll question.
Hi again, everyone. We have a question about TDAP and just a very important detail here. The question asks about 317 VFA TDAP vaccine, so not from other sources. So we are going to put the question on the screen in a second. So the question is, which of the following patient populations does your clinic administer 317 VFA Tdap vaccine to? And you have five choices, and the choices are all adults 19 years of age and older who need a tetanus vaccine booster every 10 years. The second choice is all adults as a one-time whooping cough booster vaccine. Third choice is pregnant women during each pregnancy between 27-36 weeks gestation. Fourth choice is pregnant women during each pregnancy regardless of trimester. And the last choice is members of the family in close contact of infants less than 12 months of age. So if you can take some time and answer. With the answers coming in, thank you. We're going to wait maybe less than a minute. I think we're gonna close the poll, and thank you again for answering this question. So we're compiling the results right now, and it looks like Looks like the computer is thinking, or the system is thinking. Well, we don't have percentages, but I think A, all adults 19 years of age and older who need a tetanus vaccine booster every 10 years is the answer that was chosen by the most. And Dr. Yamada is going to go over the recommendations, and hopefully you're going to see which one is the right answer or which ones are the right answers for this.
All right. So what I wanted to talk about now is basically stress the importance of Tdap with each and every pregnancy to protect young infants from pertussis. And just a little background on pertussis. I think you're all very aware of the disease. Classic pertussis has three phases. The first phase starts out with a catarrhal phase. It lasts 1 or 2 weeks classically, and it really seems like the common cold, just a runny nose, maybe a little cough, and not really that much high fever in that phase. Then it moves on to the paroxysmal phase, which can last 4 to 6 weeks. And that's where you see more of the classic pertussis symptoms, where you get the spasmodic cough, post-tussive vomiting, inspiratory whoop, and the convalescent phase, which can last up to months, where you have slowly improving symptoms. One thing of note is that infants may not present with these classic symptoms, and they can progress very, very rapidly. They may just have gagging, some vomiting, gasping, cyanosis, or apnea. They may stop breathing, or seizures may occur, rather than that classic cough or whoop. So that's an important thing to note when you're considering pertussis in a young infant. Complications can be quite severe, and the most severe complications, including seizures, encephalopathy, and death, tend to occur in our very youngest infants, especially those 2 months or younger. This slide here shows data from California from 2015 based on pertussis that has been reported to us. As you can see here, the rates of pertussis are highest in our young infants, and the Hispanic, which is in green, and white non-Hispanic populations tend to have the highest rates in our young infants. Again, that's the population who has the highest morbidity and mortality. This looks at data from 2010 to 2014 in California, looking at pertussis cases in blue. You can see in sort of that reddish color hospitalizations due to pertussis, and the diamonds with the numbers inside include the number of deaths. And what you can see from this slide is it's very skewed to the left, which again is our youngest infants, and a lot of it is really occurring even before the time that they can get their first DTaP vaccine. So this slide here shows the recommendation from both ACOG, American Academy of Family Physicians, CDC, and ACIP, that Tdap should be administered during each pregnancy, regardless of whether they got Tdap vaccine in the past. And this is really to maximize maternal antibody response and passive antibody transfer to the infant. It takes a couple weeks to get that optimal immune response. And so the optimal timing that ACIP currently recommends Tdap for is between 27 and 36 weeks gestation. And we know that a number of folks are still giving postpartum because that's what was stressed before, but the postpartum Tdap really is not as effective because it does not provide that direct antibody protection to the infant that occurs with the fetal transfer of antibodies to the young fetus. So what are the key steps to protect young infants? Again, to immunize at each and every pregnancy, preferably at 27 to 36 weeks, even if mom got Tdap in the past. It's really the most important strategy to prevent pertussis in young infants, and this is our most vulnerable population. It's preferred over cocooning. It's preferred over postpartum Tdap. And we recommend giving it at the earliest opportunity, starting at 27 weeks. That's when they'll get a good immune. It takes a couple weeks to get that good immune response, and the active antibody transport occurs really at that point, so that especially for those who may prematurely deliver, they will be still born with that protective antibody. Just a reminder not to prenatal influenza vaccine as well, as we're heading into flu season right now. Also, you may want to consider the DTaP vaccine at 6 weeks if mom didn't get that prenatal Tdap. And again, we want to encourage prompt immunization of young infants with their first set of immunizations. I wanted to share this slide here just because we have some data now from the maternal infant health assessment, which is a survey done of random survey of all live births in California. This data looks at reported receipt of Tdap vaccination during pregnancy by race, ethnicity. And again, we're at about a 45% prevalence of women who reported getting Tdap during pregnancy. It varies by race, ethnicity, a little lower in possibly in our Hispanic population. There's fairly wide confidence intervals. But what I can say here is that all women really need to get this vaccine. So we really have a way to go to get all our pregnant women immunized during that early third trimester. When we look at reported receipt of Tdap by education and family income, again, we see the highest rates in our higher income and college grad women. So we really need to improve our rates in our lower socioeconomic status women. Those tend to be the lowest rates that we see for Tdap during pregnancy. I'm going to move on a little bit to flu vaccine for pregnant women since we're talking about pregnant women. Again, all the major organizations recommend flu vaccination for women who are or will be pregnant during flu season, regardless of their trimester. So just a reminder since we're heading into flu season right now. And I wanted to share some data because we know that pregnant women are at increased risk of complications from flu. And again, our very young infants are also at increased risk of complications. And they can't get the vaccine until they're 6 months of age. And so this is one way to protect them in advance. Some data from the 2009-10 pandemic, we saw quite a few pregnant women with disease, 58 with ICU stays that year and 16 deaths in pregnant women. And again, many of our young infants as well, 56 ICU stays for young infants and 6 deaths in those infants less than 6 months of age. And looking at additional years since that time, we continue to see, unfortunately, ICU stays and deaths in both our pregnant women and our young infants. And this is based on voluntary reporting to us, so it's probably a minimum estimate. There may be more that haven't been reported to us. And when we look at that same survey, the maternal infant health assessment from 2014, about 44% of women received flu vaccine during pregnancy among the women with a recent live birth in California. So again, we have a ways to go. This slide shows data from a recent publication in Pediatrics this year, showing that the relative risk of influenza-related outcomes, including influenza-like illness, hospitalizations, or lab-confirmed influenza born to women reporting influenza vaccine during pregnancy is lower, so that you see a lower relative risk for women who got flu vaccine during pregnancy. So the message should also be not only protects women who are pregnant who are at increased complications, but it potentially can protect their young infants as well. Sometimes pregnant women will do more to protect their young infants than themselves sometimes. I wanted to also share some materials for prenatal care and immunizations that we have available on our EZIZ.com website, some of which can be ordered also from the local health department. We also have this prescription pad. Prescription pad isn't needed, but we have also heard some prenatal care providers who don't provide immunizations. And so for those who don't, we're urging them to provide it at the clinic because we know that if it's provided during that prenatal care visit, the woman is going to be more likely to get it. If it's going to be recommended and given right there when they're already there, that's the best place because women are most likely to uptake it. But if that clinic happens to not provide the vaccine, this occurs in some OBGYN clinics that we've heard. We have this prescription pad that they can give the mom. That way they don't forget which vaccines, and it's sort of a good reminder to them when they see it. and it's gotten good reviews. The OBGYNs have really enjoyed this, and if you need to use it for any reason, or if you're going to send them down the hall to get the vaccine for some reason, you could still give that to them so they don't forget. Might be a good resource for you as well. We also have some materials on pertussis for on diagnosis for providers as well. And again, that's on our easyiz.org website. Just in general, to talk a little bit about flu vaccine, the strains for this year's flu vaccine. The H1N1 strain is still the pandemic strain that hasn't changed. Our influenza A H3N2 strain has changed this year to the A Hong Kong strain. Influenza B in the trivalent sort of got switched out. This, the B Victoria, B Bisbrain, is in the trivalent this year and the quadrivalent. Last year it was only in the quadrivalent vaccine. And then when you look at the B Yamagata, the B Phuket strain, this year is only in the quadrivalent. Last year it was the one that was included in both the trivalent and the quadrivalent. So those Bs kind of got switched out, but they're the same ones that were in last year's vaccines. So the recommendation has not changed for influenza immunization. It's very simple. It's a routine annual influenza vaccination is recommended for all persons 6 months of age and older who don't have any contraindications. So ideally, you want to start vaccination before the onset of influenza activity in your community. So hopefully you've all started already. And to continue it as long as influenza viruses are circulating and you have an expired vaccine. But we're urging you right now, this is the beginning of our flu season, so please, please immunize all your patients against influenza. I like this reference. This is from the Immunization Action Coalition. It has all the licensed flu vaccines and the ages and some billing codes that might be helpful for you. This is updated every year from the Immunization Action Coalition. It's a very nice reference. So what influenza vaccine products should be given? What ACIP states is that a licensed age-appropriate vaccine should be used, and there's no preferential recommendation for one influenza vaccine product over another for persons who have more than one licensed recommended product that's appropriate. I did want to, since I'm talking about pregnant women, just remind you that there is in law, women who are knowingly pregnant or for a child less than 3 years of age, they shouldn't receive a vaccine that has more than a certain amount of mercury in it. And that really, for flu, really just affects those multi-dose vials of influenza vaccine. All the single-dose vials, single-dose syringes contain less than that amount. So for your pregnant women, just make sure you use a single-dose formulation of the flu vaccine. I thought I would just mention this. There were some updates in this year's ACIP recommendations on egg allergies. And basically, the summary is really overall is that studies have really looked at both the nasal flu spray and flu shots in egg-allergic and non-egg-allergic patients. And they really indicate that severe allergic reactions, even in people with egg allergies, with flu vaccine is very unlikely. And you know, there's very, very little egg protein in our flu vaccine nowadays. And so they really softened up a lot of the language this year in the recommendations. They removed the 30-minute post-vaccination observation period and really just have the same recommendation for all vaccines and all patients to that you should consider observing all patients for 15 minutes after vaccination. And so that is continues for those for flu vaccine, even if they're egg allergic. Egg allergic persons can receive any licensed recommended vaccines that's otherwise appropriate. And that would this year be any inactivated vaccine available or the recombinant vaccine, which is our only egg-free vaccine. And then there's one additional that remains for people who have a history of allergic reaction to egg, but it really should be there for anybody who gives vaccines is that it should be administered in a basically a facility in an inpatient or outpatient medical setting, and vaccine administration should be supervised by a healthcare provider who is able to recognize and manage severe allergic reactions. And again, like for all vaccines, one of the contraindications for any vaccines, if you've had a previous severe allergic reaction, anaphylaxis, to influenza vaccine, regardless of the component, that's a contraindication to receipt of flu vaccine in the future. And that's the same for any vaccine, really. So, again, this is a reminder for our healthcare providers on the line. If you work with patients, you need a flu vaccine every year. So just make sure that to take care of yourself as well and get your flu shot, as well as making sure your patients get theirs. I'm going to go through some resources. Again, here's some resources from both the CDC and the Immunization Action Coalition. They're wonderful resources. This is a resource on the benefits of flu vaccination from CDC on their website. And that makes a compelling message. This is one of our materials that we always put out. It's very useful to kind of look at the various age groups and what vaccines are licensed for certain age groups and what they look like. This is something that can easily be posted at your clinic as well. Again, some of our materials on easyiz.org. So we have another poll question.
So this question refers to the vaccines that your clinic is planning to offer to adults that come in for their flu shots this season. And we have a list of six vaccines here. And while the question is getting uploaded, I will remind you that you can pick more than one answer. And thank you again for helping us with getting this information. Again, this and the Tdap question, they're going to really help us plan better and figure out better ways to support you. So the question is, yes, the question is not uploaded yet. It is. Okay, the question is up. Which of the following vaccines does your clinic plan to offer to adults coming in for their flu shot this season? And the seven options are listed there. If you can please take about a minute and answer. You can pick more than one answer.
I don't know if it's open. Can't see the question. We're working on getting the question pulled up right now.
It looks like we only have about 15 minutes, and we still haven't answered questions, and we still have some slides to go through, so maybe we can skip this one. Thank you again for answering the first question, and we'll gather this information from you another way, so thank you.
Okay. All right. So I'll go ahead and move on. I'm just going to touch very briefly on some catch-up vaccines. This is a good opportunity if you have adults coming in to catch up on some vaccines that they may not have gotten yet. In particular, HPV vaccine. We know our rates of three-dose HPV vaccine is still very, very low in our adolescent populations, and we're working to improve that. We ideally want to give it at 11 or 12 years of age, but we know a lot have not. So for females, it's recommended through the age of 26 years. For males, the recommendation is through the age of 21 years, but a permissive recommendation as well through the age of 26 years, as well as a full recommendation for males who are MSM, immunocompromised, and we have HIV through 26 years. So don't forget that for your younger adults that may be coming in. Also, MMR vaccine and varicella vaccine, if they don't have evidence of past disease, they may be indicated for 2 doses of varicella vaccine, and for MMR, 1 or 2 doses, depending on the population or indication. Again, for healthcare providers, it is recommend 2 doses. Those traveling internationally as well should be getting 2 doses as well. In addition, the following vaccines may be given to certain populations as well. The MenV vaccine is recommended for certain high-risk persons, but it's also recommended sort of as a permissive recommendation. Depending on the vaccine you use, it's either a 2 or 3 dose series, and it may be given for short-term protection against most MenV strains for persons basically 16 through 23 years of age is a general recommendation for non-high-risk populations with a preferred age of 16 to 18. But if you have someone coming in who's a little older, who's concerned about meningococcal disease, you have the option of giving that vaccine to that population through the age of 23 years. And again, the recommendation would be for anyone 10 years and older for those high-risk groups. And I have a slide at the end that has that information. The hepatitis B vaccine series and hepatitis A vaccine series, both of those, if someone's seeking protection against either Hep A or Hep B, they can get that. That's a permissive recommendation for ACIP, and it's also a full recommendation for some certain high-risk groups as well. But for Hep A and B, that's the ACIP recommendation. If they're interested in getting protection, ACIP says that you can give that. So in summary, both PPSV23 and PCV13, if you haven't, they haven't yet received it, is recommended for persons 65 years of age and older. You want to give PCV13 first if they haven't yet gotten that. Any vaccines, pneumococcal vaccines, again, for persons with high-risk indications, they're also recommended to receive the polysaccharide vaccines, and some groups also the conjugate vaccines before age 65 years. And make sure to review the resources about intervals by age and indication as well as their high-risk condition. It's very confusing, so I encourage you to relook at that, those references after the webinar today. Again, all persons 60 years of age and older are recommended to receive the zoster vaccine. Pregnant women are recommended to receive Tdap with each and every pregnancy at 27 through 36 weeks gestation, and I know ACIP is going to look at sort of the timing of that again at this upcoming October meeting. Again, all persons 6 months and older are recommended to receive the influenza vaccine annually. Particularly our highest risk adults are at high risk of influenza and its complications. And just as a reminder, when you're giving flu, remember the pneumococcal vaccine, because that's a very prevalent infection that can cause serious disease, particularly in our older adults, and often complicates influenza. So this is a great time to give both of those if they're not up to date. And then again, other vaccines may be indicated to catch up or due to high-risk indications. I thought I'd end just really quickly with how should I approach improving immunization rates at your clinic. One of the things I put up here is data that you can get from the HRSA website or you probably have available at your clinic itself. Just look at your clinic population and your resources. You can look at the numbers. You can look at some of the populations you may be following already for other HRSA quality of care indicators. You may have a lot of patients with diabetes. You may have a lot of patients who are going to your clinic for prenatal care. This example shows no patients with HIV, but you may be a clinic that sees a lot of patients with HIV. So take a look at your population and your staffing as well. What's going to be what's going to be something that could be easily incorporated? And what's happened within your population? Have you had a recent death and maybe a young infant due to pertussis, and that might be a motivating factor for staff to go ahead and do that? Maybe you have a lot of good workflows already written out for diabetes care, and you have a good care coordinator that's really motivated to improve immunization rates. So that might be a good place to start. So the main thing when you're looking at maybe a focus for your immunization efforts is making sure that leadership is engaged, that you have a motivating champion, that you have people who are willing to work towards these goals, and look at where it would be the biggest impact. Look both at your populations, look at, you know, the deaths or hospitalizations that have occurred in your patient population, and agree upon some concrete goals and objectives throughout the entire clinic. And know what your population is. A lot of times you have definitions for some of these defined populations like patients with diabetes because you're already looking at them. Calculate your baseline and make sure you're giving your team feedback based on different interventions that you try, both to the individual clinician and the whole care team. If you're working on perhaps a population either with a certain health condition or all women who are seeking prenatal care, and look at feasibility too and the sustainability of your efforts. You may have a care manager that's already working on a disease and that can incorporate it into some clinic workflows that you might already have available, and it can be easily done. You also want to make sure you engage all staff, not just the clinicians. You want to engage the front office staff, anyone who might be seeing the patient, so that it becomes more likely. Standing orders might be useful within your clinic as well. So take a look at all these things to see what might be most helpful. I put this in because there was a recent article about the 10 building blocks of high-performing primary care. I think a lot of the FQHCs already use a lot of these tenets, but I thought I would throw that in there in case you want to read more. And these are just examples of some target populations you might choose. Whether it's age-based, you may choose 60 years and older and target zoster vaccine, or 65 years and older and also include the pneumococcal vaccines. You may want to target pregnant women with Tdap and flu vaccine coming up this year. And then some other populations based on risk groups. One of the things I wanted to mention also is for patients with HIV infection. Recently, ACIP voted that all persons with HIV infection should also make sure they receive the meningococcal conjugate vaccine. That would be Menveo or Menactra, and that was a recent ACIP vote. So again, here is a list of a lot of the good resources I always point people to, list of the ACIP recommendations, the schedule, which also has a list of all the contraindications and precautions on there, so that's a great resource. I think Gabriella put some of these things in your welcome packet, the intake form and the immunization screening checklist, which I think are really two very useful tools as well. Again, these are all really good resources for you, so take a look at those. If you want to get certain materials, some of them are available in print form, so you can get it from your local health department, and others are available, all of them should be available on easyiz.org as well, most of them. I want to acknowledge my colleagues as well who either did some of the data analysis, provided slides, or helped with a lot of the resources. Both here and outside. I'm going to end here and, I guess, take questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Yamada. It was a very informative presentation, and it was amazing to me that you can have so much information in only 50 minutes or so. So now we're ready to take questions.
Certainly. If you'd like to ask a question, please unmute your phone first, press *1, and record your name. I do require a name to introduce your question. If you'd like to withdraw your question, you can press *2. But again, to ask a question, please unmute your phone first, press *1, and record your name. It does take a few moments for those questions to come through, however, so please stand by. All right, we have one question queued up here. I believe the name is Ileana. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. I have a question. I know that you guys said in the beginning that we don't know if zoster is effective after 5 years of giving the immunization. Should we revaccinate the patient or just wait until further study?
Oh, thank you for that question. Yes, right now the ACIP recommendation is just for one dose. I think some of the studies, when they looked at it, at the efficacy of the effectiveness of the vaccine over time, it did go down. What they saw after 5 years was this very wide confidence interval. So right now, ACIP does not recommend a booster or anything like that for the zoster vaccine. So right now, it's just one dose. And as you can see, our rates are really low. So I think we should concentrate on just getting everybody one dose of the vaccine and just following ACIP recommendations. They are monitoring this really closely, and so either if a booster dose is recommended, we will hear from ACIP, and I think that will be our best resources. But I think we have a long way to go just to get one dose. I think that's
concentrated. Okay, sounds good.
And we have another question queued up. This one comes from Michelle. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. So my question has to do with the zoster and the Medi-Cal coverage. I did call Medi-Cal here, which is the Central California Alliance for Health, and they claim that they do not cover the zoster vaccine. And so my question is, on the VFA qualification, it states that if they have a Medi-Cal managed care plan, they do not qualify for a VFA vaccine.
That's surprising, because I do know that I've looked at the Medi-Cal provider manual, the general one through DHCS, and I know that when zoster vaccine was first licensed and recommended, they added the zoster vaccine for to that to the Medi-Cal provider manual. And I know that the managed care plans are supposed to cover all ACIP recommended vaccines for adults. So maybe you have my email. Maybe email me online and. Because that's surprising to me. I think that they should cover it, but maybe I need to follow up with that. They really should, because we've communicated with Medi-Cal Managed Care, and they've told us that the plan should cover all ACIP-recommended vaccines. So I'm happy to follow up with that.
I've called twice with the NDC number, and they just have stated that it's not on their formulary and that they do not cover it.
Okay. I will follow up with you after that, because it really should be covered, and I'll work with you on that. We've heard some glitches for various things before, and we've been able to solve them when we've gone through the regular means. So thank you.
You can send the question also to my317vaccines.com, at CDPH, so we can collect the questions that way as well.
Great. Thank you.
And I have no further questions in the queue.
So we have one more minute till 1, so I think we can just stop here. Thank you, everyone, again, for attending.
Maybe I'll...
And, yes?
Well, if we have... Let me see. Oh, no, I think it's time.
Just 1 minute, yeah.
I did want to give one little update that I was going to include an extra slide. I just wanted to point out one of the things that I think a lot of folks aren't familiar with for hepatitis B vaccine recommendations is that persons with diabetes are also recommended for hepatitis B vaccine, the full recommendation for persons less than 60 years of age for hepatitis B. So I did want to mention that, because it's a fairly recent recommendation. And I'll leave it there.
Great. Thank you. And again, if you have any questions, please email us at my317vaccines@cdph.ca.gov. Again, thank you, everyone, for being here today, and we look forward to seeing you or talking to you for the next webinar, which I think is going to be scheduled sometime during the month of January 2017. Thank you.
And that does conclude our call for today. Thank you all for participating. You may disconnect at this time.